Welcome back to the Fitz News Studios for the Week in Review. A huge week on the Rockstar cheer front. This story has been dominating our coverage for several weeks now. This week, no exception. A major development in this case with the filing of an amended federal lawsuit in U.S. District Court that dramatically escalates this story. We're going to tell you all about that in our lead segment coming up in just a minute. We're also going to dive into some new developments in another sex scandal, one involving the Baptist Church and the Southern Baptist Convention. Our director of special projects, Dylan Nolan, did a big piece on that. He's actually going to come on the set and give you an update on that story. We're going to dive into a little bit of Murdoch murders. There wasn't a whole lot of news on that front, but we do have a very interesting Murdoch story that dips sort of from the realm of fact to fiction. It's going to be an interesting exchange and a little bit controversial too, I might add. Last but not least, we're going to dive into the subject of fentanyl. And again, not one of the drugs that I've tried. Tried most of the other ones, but we're going to talk about the impact of fentanyl and whether or not the state of South Carolina needs a new law to hold those who are trafficking that substance accountable. Stay tuned for all that and much more on your Week in Review. All right, so the big news this week in the Rockstar Cheer saga, the filing of an amended federal complaint in U.S. District Court in Greenville, South Carolina. I've got a copy of it right here, complete with my nice pink page clips. Very impressive. If you can't see this on the podcast, you can hear these pages, folks. This is a substantive document. This is a serious document. This is a major expansion of this story. We're talking about new defendants. We're talking about new plaintiffs. And most importantly, I believe, we're talking about an entirely new wrinkle to this story, to the alleged corporate corruption that has been mainlining sexual abuse in the cheerleading industry in the United States. But before we dive into this complaint and the revelations contained herein, I wanted to remind our readers, our viewers, our listeners, that we've got a new offering related to this story. I'm talking about Cheer Incorporated, which is the podcast that launched earlier this week on Tuesday, our first edition. We are digging deep into this story, people, amplifying our coverage on Fitz News, that exclusive, extensive coverage of this saga. And I wanted to cut real quick to a clip from that featuring our host, the Director of Research, Jen Wood. Let's take a listen.
I am a cheer mom. My daughter cheers. I was a cheerleader. My aunts cheered. All of my friends cheered. And now a lot of their daughters cheer. It's a community. And while we joke about how cutthroat it's become, when it works the way it's supposed to work, it becomes more than a competition, more than just some part of our culture. It becomes a true sisterhood, a true brotherhood. When it works the way it's supposed to, it becomes something bigger than the sum of its parts, or even that part of us that it fulfills. We become something bigger. We become a team. We share in one another's triumphs. We shoulder each other's defeats. We bond together, support each other, lift each other up, and give each other strength. And it's not for ribbons or medals or jackets or rings. It's not for the trips, trophies, or bragging rights at school. It's for each other. But cheer is more than that. It's a trust. It's putting the most precious thing in your life in the hands of someone else. And it's praying that the other parent, coach, trainer, or choreographer looks at your child and my child and sees the same purity and purpose that we see. Cheer is a trust that those who are placed in positions of authority over our sons and our daughters are honest, fair, decent, and well-intentioned people. That their motivation through all those practices and performances is to bring out only the best in our children. That they would, in fact, protect our children from anything threatening that purity of purpose. Yeah, cheer is a trust. And that trust can be shattered in a second. How do I know? Because as I record this, the biggest cheerleading scandal in the history of the country is about to break wide open.
All right, so that's an excerpt from Cheer, Inc., the first episode, which aired, again, this Tuesday. Our next episode coming next Tuesday. And folks, based on this complaint, based on the interviews that we conducted with attorneys at the Strom Law Firm related to this complaint, it's going to be one you won't want to miss. Let's just dive into this document. I don't even know where to start with it because as a dad, you read this stuff, it chills you. It's chilling. I want to start with one of the new defendants in this case. He's a cheer instructor, also went to the University of Louisville with Scott Foster, was a cheerleader with Scott Foster at the University of Louisville. He's been incredibly successful in the industry like Scott Foster. I'm referring to Kenny Feely. Now, we're going to put his picture up here for those of you on the podcast. We're looking at some interesting pictures here of this guy with his dog in matching clothes. I don't know if that should have been a giveaway. If you got matching clothes for you and your... What the heck kind of dog is that anyway? Anybody? Anyway, this guy, Kenny Feely, we've heard about this guy before. In fact, when we first broke this story back in late August, we started hearing from readers, from listeners, from viewers about Touchy Feely. That's what they called this guy, allegedly. Touchy Feely. Anyway, I want to read from the complaint because this is stuff that, again, if you're a parent, if you're a cheer parent, this should just chill you. From the federal suit. Defendant Feely climbed into bed with plaintiff Jane Doe, groped and fondled her, digitally penetrated her. She's 16 years old at the time. In another instance, Foster, again, this is the guy whose suicide kicked this entire thing off. Foster hooked Feely up with a private training session with this same defendant, or same survivor, I'm sorry. After this training session, takes her off-site, gives her alcohol and marijuana, takes her to a secondary location, rapes her. Let's go into another one. This is Jane Doe 7. And this young woman is 13 years old, people. 13 years old. And another rock star coach, a Nathan Allen Plank, is allegedly sending her nude pictures and videos of him masturbating. This is a grown man allegedly sending this material to a 13-year-old girl. I got 7 kids, people. And again, I'm gonna be a little personal here. I've got 7 kids. One of them is a 13-year-old girl. I'm going to tell you right now, if I hear of this, if I read of this, if I am told of this with any degree of evidentiary likelihood, then my lawyers are going to be interviewing me in a detention center and trying to figure out how to get me off of a murder rap. And I, for the life of me, do not understand this culture that allowed this to happen. And we spent most of the day on Thursday speaking with the attorneys at the Strom Law Firm who were talking about this culture. Jen Wood, our researcher, has spent the last few weeks speaking with cheer moms talking about this culture. I don't understand this. I'm going to go back into this. Sending nude photos, sending videos of himself masturbating when this girl's 13. But Plank wasn't the only one who allegedly victimized this particular Jane Doe. She's listed as Jane Doe 7. I want to say whoever you are, Jane Doe 7. I can't believe what you had to go through. But there's another rock star defendant who allegedly forces her to perform oral sex on him. At 14 years old. Here's the crazy thing. This was reported to the Greenville County Sheriff's Department. We're still trying to find out exactly what they did with that information. This was reported. It was reported by the girl's mom after this young woman. I'm sorry. This is just, if this doesn't get to you, there's something, I don't know. But I want to talk about what happened here because this is the key part of this story, and this goes back to this culture that I don't understand. These allegations were not only reported to law enforcement, they were reported to the gym. They were reported to USASF, the U.S. All-Star Federation, which is this so-called oversight entity that, along with USA Cheer, is supposed to be protecting the safety of these cheerleading athletes. It was reported to Varsity, which is the for-profit entity, which basically is the puppet master of these watchdog groups, these nonprofits. They knew, people. They knew. And again, here's what I don't get. We see this over and over again as we've been investigating this story. And in fact, we've seen it since the Scott Foster suicide that, again, was the sort of the breaking point for all this, that thrust all this into the limelight. We see this culture of cover-up, of protecting these coaches, most of whom are former cheerleaders. Again, this is an industry. It's a cycle. If you're a cheerleader, your goal is to be a coach. If you're a coach, your goal is to start your own gym. And the successful coaches, they are, I heard one of the attorneys say yesterday, they are gods in this industry. Well, no God I believe in, I'll tell you that right now. Because again, I do not understand how this can happen and how parents and others in this industry can rally around these people and defend them. Because here's what happened to this girl. Let me tell you, we're going to read this part. And this was, to me, even more shocking than the allegations. This poor girl's mother reported this, as she should have done. And she was told that if she didn't like the atmosphere at Rockstar, that she could, and I quote, find another gym. It's just unbelievable. So you get abused. You're scared to report it because you don't want to be held back in these programs, which are incredibly competitive. This particular Jane Doe had a younger sister in the program too, and she was worried that if she came forward, that it would adversely impact her sister's standing within the rock star community. But again, they came forward. They were courageous. And they were told, no, that didn't happen. They were told, go find another gym. If you don't like it here, go find another gym. Well, the problem that we're finding, folks, is that there are far too many gyms in South Carolina and across this country where this stuff is happening. And that brings me to another key point I want to talk about as it relates to this lawsuit. And I want to talk about where this thing's headed, folks. I want to talk about not only the cases that we've seen now. This is not the only case, this big complaint I'm holding here in my hands, the amended complaint filed in Greenville this week. There are cases at the state level already filed, more coming, according to attorneys who have spoken with this news outlet. So there's a flood of legal action coming on the civil side. And I spoke with attorney Bakari Sellers earlier this week at Strom Law Firm. He told me there are cases coming in Tennessee, two cases, two lawsuits that are going to be filed in federal court in Tennessee. There's one coming in North Carolina. There's one coming in Georgia, at least one in Georgia. One coming in Florida. Another in Maryland. And this is just the start. This is just the start, people. Just the depth of this. We had no idea when we started covering this. No idea. No idea. We knew there were allegations against Scott Foster. We knew that in the immediate aftermath of his suicide, we were able to confirm there was a federal investigation into him, into Rockstar Cheer. We had no idea where it was going. No idea it would be this big. And most disturbingly to me as a dad, and most disturbingly, hopefully for you, as a parent or somebody who just cares about future generations in this country, we had no idea that there was this insidious culture within this industry that enabled these predators to get away with this kind of stuff. Again, I got a 13-year-old daughter. Let me tell you right now, you send a dick pic, a jerk-off video to that girl, again, my lawyers will be talking to me in a detention center because you will quite simply be dead. All right. Now that's out of the way, let's dive back into this suit. The big news here for me as a reporter, I'm going to take the dad hat off real quick and put the reporter hat on. The big news here from a news standpoint wasn't the particular graphic, shocking allegations of sexual abuse the big news here from a reporting standpoint, and as this case moves forward, and as we search for accountability for those acts, for those just a horrific culture, as we seek accountability there, the big news here was the escalation of this case to RICO status. And I'm referring to the first line in the lawsuit. Very first line in the amended complaint is incredibly important to this case moving forward because it alleges, and I quote, a civil conspiracy in violation of the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act. That's RICO, folks. That's a criminal enterprise. These lawyers are essentially saying this is not just one or two people acting in a silo, acting in isolation, acting independent of each other. Although I'm sure that's an element of this, but they're claiming that this is a coordinated effort, that these defendants are acting collaboratively, that they are acting in coordination with each other. And the lawsuit gets into that, and I wanted to read this. And this is, I think, the most important line in the lawsuit because I think it sums up exactly what's at stake here, what the essence of this case is. And they're referring again to this collective group of defendants as a criminal enterprise. That's the definition of RICO, folks, a criminal enterprise. It says that this enterprise acted together and associated together for the common purpose of recklessly, intentionally, and willfully endangering plaintiffs as minor athletes by exposing them to illegal sexual abuse and the exploitation of children while assuring parents that they were particularly safe in order to take their money. And again, on Cheer Incorporated, the podcast, we dug into that profit motive extensively. We're going to continue to do that. And again, to me, the profit side of it is secondary, but I think it is the motive. And again, if you have a profit motive, that's fine. It's okay to have a profit motive. That's what we're in America. That's what we're here for. At least that's what I thought we were here for. That's what we're supposed to be here for. If you're a free market person, if you're a free enterprise supporter like me. But when the profit motive consumes you and clouds your judgment to the point that you are allowing conduct like this to go not only unchecked or unreported, but when you're facilitating it, when you're covering it up, and when you're, according to this lawsuit, actually collaborating. And there's some timing in this lawsuit that's incredibly important, folks. And we discussed this briefly on the first edition of Cheer Incorporated. We've discussed it at length on Fitz News about when some of these allegations against Scott Foster were first made. We've talked about the fact that some of the sex abuse allegations were first made in 2017. Which is right around the time that Varsity, the big corporate defendant in this case, was in negotiations to be sold to Bain Capital for, again, $2.5 to $2.8 billion, depending on which number you look at. That is huge money. That is huge money. And I, for the life of me, can't understand how a company, you know, again, founded by Mitt Romney, the former presidential candidate, how does a company like that overlook this or miss this? I don't think they do. I don't think they could have. You don't spend that kind of money not knowing what you're buying. I mean, we're not talking about kicking the tires of a vehicle or just looking under the hood, which, by the way, would have been all you had to do to figure out exactly what was going on within this industry. But if you're spending that kind of money, you are going to tear that car apart and build it back together. Find out exactly what's going through every valve. So don't tell me that didn't happen. Which reminds me, it's interesting, another new defendant listed in the amended complaint that was filed in district court is Jeff Webb. Now, this is the guy we're going to be hearing a lot about in the coming days. Jeff Webb from Oklahoma, founded Varsity back in 1974. He is, you want to talk about these people refer to the gods of this industry. Well, this would be Zeus. Jeff Webb would be the Zeus of the cheerleading industry. And in fact, I think he, what does he call himself, Eagle or something? I don't know what he's got, some cute name for himself, whatever. But this guy's going to factor into the narrative increasingly as this story continues to unfold. And so one of the things I wanted to focus on as we do that, because the Jeff Webb angle is interesting. Jeff Webb, if he is listed in this lawsuit as essentially the architect of this conspiracy. The lawsuit specifically names him as the individual who basically set this whole thing up. So it's going to be very interesting to watch that move forward, and particularly as the lawsuits in Tennessee are filed. at the federal level, because again, Varsity is a Tennessee-based corporation. That's Jeff Webb's home state. That's where he is now. So we will be following that very closely as it moves forward. Again, so much here, so much to this story. We had no idea where this was going, but I can tell you one thing, folks. As this case continues to unfold, as we continue to dig into this document, into the lawsuits that are to come, into the criminal investigation that is ongoing. By the way, that investigation has yet to produce charges. But if the allegations contained in this report against particularly Kenny Feely and the five other Rockstar coaches that were named in this complaint, Nathan Allen Plank, another one of them, if these allegations are true, criminal charges will be coming. They will be coming. Again, folks, this is bigger than a news story. This is bigger than a podcast. This is bigger than a lawsuit. This is a deciding point for us as a culture. How are we going to treat our kids? And when we find that they've been mistreated in the most egregious, reprehensible, perverted, predatory way, here's the real question. What are we going to do about it? Well, I'll tell you what Fitz News is going to do about it. We're going to continue every day working to expose those who perpetrated this kind of conduct and hold them accountable. Count on us to do that as this story moves forward. All right, so we're moving from one institutional sex abuse scandal to another. And I brought our director of special projects, Dylan Nolan. He's usually behind the camera, but he's out in front today because he was the one that covered another big story that broke on our news outlet this week involving a sex abuse scandal at a Baptist church here in the Midlands region of South Carolina. Dylan, tell us a little bit about this Northside scandal.
Right. This is a Northside scandal, but much like how the Rockstar Cheer scandal starts with Rockstar Cheer, starts with Scott Foster, this particular case is allegedly perpetrated by a guy named Mike Diatoma. He's a serial youth pastor. I say serial because he has been at multiple churches, been kicked out, and for alleged sexual abuse of children, and has been allowed to continue to work at other churches. Now, this to me is something that is crazy that was still happening, because I grew up in the Northeast in the time frame where the Catholic Church was getting busted for quite literally taking a priest who's been accused of sexual abuse and moving them to a different parish. And what we're seeing here out of the Southern Baptist Convention, which is the second largest Christian denomination only to the Catholic Church in the United States, it's not quite the same behavior. The Catholic Church would take people and actively move them. The Southern Baptist Convention, on the other hand, says, we are churches which are separate, but which come together for certain things. However, we don't have the ability to have this level of oversight. And the reason that this happened was that there was a small contingent of people at the upper levels of leadership of the Southern Baptist Convention that would actively minimize sexual abuse complaints and make sure that it didn't make it down to the actual church leaders, which resulted in decades of very similar things to what you were just discussing in the last segment with these rock star victims, where people would come forward only to be told to shut up. And you see this in this lawsuit and allegations which are leveled against the Southern Baptist Convention. And then you see it specifically in this case. I know that one thing that stuck out to you in our conversation was the comment regarding staying quiet for the pastor's marriage's sake. And I think that that speaks to the culture where somebody actually would stay quiet for the pastor's marriage's sake. That's something that somebody would say in a serious context. And I think that for situations like this to stop happening, adults need to have stones and say, screw the marriage of this pastor. I mean, if you're coming after children, your marriage probably is not worth much. Screw my social standing at this gym, which may or may not be operated by a cabal of pedophiles. The question here is not, why are these pedophiles doing this? I mean, they're in situations where they have easy access to children. The question is, why do adults blindly trust them? And I think that that's what our goal is here both to hold the institutions accountable, which is something you just talked about a lot, but to me it's to hold ourselves accountable, to look at adults who have access to children and really question their motives. If you're an adult who puts yourself in a position in your life where all you do is have access to children all day, if you're somebody who's not a pedophile, it's tough because people are going to look at you and think, why are they doing this? But at the same time, it clearly needs to be done. Right. And obviously, these are just allegations.
Right. Well, and obviously, there's thousands of people out there that work with kids who are utter altruists, who have those kids' best interests at heart, and we rely on them as parents to help us shape.
Some of my teachers growing up, I mean, they were the most altruistic, gave all of who they were as people to their students, and in a completely beautiful way. And without those people, I wouldn't know how to write. I would not have a job here, you know?
None of us would be doing what we're able to do without those people. I guess what you're pointing out is kind of like we talked about in the last segment, is what do we do when we find out that there's people that are, and particularly at an institutional level, misbehaving? I guess the big question is, why aren't these institutions, whether it's the church, whether it's that cheerleading industry, why aren't they holding themselves accountable, their own people accountable? That's the real question, isn't it?
Like, I would guess money and power. I mean, you in the Rockstar saga, you have an easy answer. Money. Mm-hmm. That Bain Capital purchase, as you've referenced multiple times, makes it clear. Bain Capital does not buy your company unless there is serious cash inflow. In a religious context, I think it's a lot more complicated because there are interpersonal relationships where maybe your wife's friends with that pastor's wife, and you don't want to put them in a position where their whole marriage with their two little kids falls apart. Mm-hmm. So there's complex circumstances there, but there's certainly a point where you need to pull the lens back and say, this is not okay under any circumstances.
Absolutely. Well, some eerie parallels with this story with Rockstar. And again, a great report by Dylan Nolan, our director of special projects. Dylan does so much for us, again, that you don't see, but I love it when he gets out publishing stories like this. And thanks for coming on, Dylan, and sharing this with us. And you're going to stay on this case?
Certainly. I'll be interested to see. The next step is mediation that's required in all civil cases. I don't know how that's going to go just based on the filings that we've seen thus far, but once it moves past that, I will certainly be checking the index and providing updates to our audience.
Absolutely. And speaking of that, a reminder to our audience, if you've got a story of abuse like this at a church that you attend or a church that a friend attends, let us know. Because again, this news outlet, just as we're showing in the Rockstar Cheer saga, this story, we're committed to holding these institutions accountable. And we're committed to holding the individuals accountable who perpetrate these acts. So if you've got a story you want us to investigate, if you've got a story where you've got evidence of these sorts of just horrific behaviors, let us know. We will dig in and we will cover the stories the way they need to be covered. Thank you, Dylan, for covering this one the way it needed to be covered.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, so it's been a quiet week on the Murdaugh murders, crime and corruption front, and I'm starting to wonder if that's because defense attorney Dick Harpootlian, who's been quite bombastic and quite vocal and just dominating headlines on this for a month, went absolutely radio silent like a Russian sub when he got the discovery in this case. I wonder if he's looking at those documents and having a bit of an oh shit moment. I wonder. Anyway, we do hope to get attorney Harpootlian in here at some point. Been quite harsh on him, on his handling of this case up to this point, but he has kind of rallied. At least he had rallied, but again, gone kind of quiet over the last few weeks. But the big Murdaugh news this week was actually something that you never know where this story's going. And what we saw this week was just yet another example of that, except it wasn't in the realm of reality, of the case, of the investigation, of the civil suits and all the attendant legal drama. It was actually in the realm of fiction. And I'm referring to a story that was broken by Mike DeWitt of the Hampton County Guardian, which is a Gannett publication. Mike has been doing some great work, by the way, on this Murdaugh story. In fact, real quick, some shout-outs. Valerie Borlein with the Wall Street Journal, Mandy Matney on her podcast, Mike DeWitt with Gannett. These are some folks just doing great work on the Murdaugh stuff. So hats off to folks who are doing a good job on the story. But DeWitt's story. I've never seen anything like this. There is a Murdoch Murders masquerade ball. Although it's not technically the Murdochs, because this story is set not in Hampton County, but Frampton County. And I'm sure Dylan's probably pulling up a Peter Frampton, "Do You Feel Like I Do" guitar riff right now, because that was the first thing that came into my head. But Frampton County, and this story centers around an alleged murder of a prominent local person. And there's a journalist apparently involved in this story, too. I don't know who they're referring to there or who that's going to be, but they're selling tickets to this thing in Hampton County. This is literally being produced by the Hampton Arts Foundation down there in Hampton, South Carolina, and they're hosting a dinner party masquerade ball, formal attire, to celebrate a murder mystery. And the invitation, by the way, says someone will die. Someone will be killed. So I don't know. I'm actually thinking about going to this thing. I mean, why the hell not? I mean, but anyway, this story has created just revulsion across the Murdoch Murders universe and some of the crazy holes that people dive into on Reddit and places like that. By the way, I've apparently pissed Reddit off. I didn't know you could do that, but apparently the people in their parents' basement on Reddit don't like me very much at the moment. That's okay. That's okay. Next time I'm at my parents' basement, I'll identify with you. Because I'm betting a lot of you identify as people that don't live in your parents' basement. And I'm with you. You stay with that, guys. Stay with that. It'll happen for you one day, I promise. But this thing is blown up. And this poor theater director down there, Heather, her name, I think her name's Heather. She seems pretty cool to me. I mean, I actually reached out to her and asked her about this thing. I said, "Hey, you know, you're getting beat up. What's the deal?" And according to her, this story was actually written back in 2007. So that's, what is that, 14 years before the double homicide that again thrust this Murdoch story into the international limelight. And so according to her, it's sort of like, hey, what's the fuss about? But just a huge scandal related to this thing, the town up in arms. But they're apparently selling tickets like hotcakes. And again, I'm thinking about buying some tickets. I might go to this thing. And again, the critics are saying it makes light of this story. It detracts from the memory of victims, et cetera. And again, I don't know. I mean, I feel like this theater group, from the beginning of this story, they've been trying to redefine Hampton. They've been trying to sort of show the world that there's more to the town than just this corrupt family, than just this international saga that has kind of gripped everybody's attention. Again, maybe they could have picked a better way to do it, but I don't really begrudge them for that. Because if I lived in Hampton, South Carolina, I'd want the same thing. I don't want to be identified forever with this family that basically was the feudal lords over the area. So again, I think they're having some fun with it. It doesn't really bother me. And yeah, you know, who knows? Maybe I will go down there. Maybe we'll go down to Hampton, South Carolina and check this thing out. It's happening in October. Tickets, by the way, $50. We'll put the link up here if you want to get them. It's a Palmetto Theater right there. You can check it out. We'll put that link up and let you, if you want to go, check it out, see what it's all about. But again, I think this just highlights people have just gotten so on edge with this story. This story's become so personal for so many people. And again, it should. It should. But if you live in Hampton and your town's been dragged through the mud, again, because of something that most of the people that live there, arguably, they have no culpability on it. I'm sure there are plenty that do. Palmetto State Bank, Russell Lafitte, Corey Fleming, the attorney from Beaufort. A lot of the people in power down there had a lot to do with it. But if you're a Hampton County Joe Blow, Jane, you know, you didn't do this. So put your tux on. Have a little fun. Have a dinner party. Anyway, if we do go, we'll keep our readers and viewers and listeners up to speed on whether or not this is the offensive thing that its critics have said or whether it is just good-natured fun. But again, a weird development in the Murdoch Murders crime and corruption saga, an instance where art imitates life. So we'll see what that's all about next month when that event is held. All right, so we got some other news this week on the drug front. And before we get into this, I just have to say, I have done pretty much every drug under the sun, folks. A lot of mushrooms, a lot of weed, a little bit of that. Did crystal meth once, but it made my stomach hurt. So luckily that was not something I became a big fan of. God knows what would have happened if I didn't get that stomach ache, though. But anyway, did a lot of drugs. Thankfully, though, 15, 16 years ago, got sober. And with the exception of a gummy that was force-fed by my wife, been sober ever since. But I've adopted, if you're a regular member of our audience, you know this, I've adopted a very libertarian view when it comes to drugs. I think that people in the privacy of their own homes should be allowed to get high if they want. Okay? Just, why would we stop that? I mean, why would we shut down a potentially viable sector of the economy if people just want to get high in their homes or sitting out on the beach or whatever? Obviously, there are limits to that. If you got kids in the house, if you're driving, I mean, seriously, you've got obvious parameters to this, but I'm not a big supporter of drug legislation, of drug regulation. I don't like to be supportive of new drug laws because, again, I think I'm a Austrian school guy, a laissez-faire, free market dude, individual liberty. But, and this is an important but, when we talk about fentanyl, when we talk about this new generation of synthetic substances, which are hundreds of times more powerful than the stuff I was smoking back in college, it's a different ballgame. It's a much different ballgame. And I think that in addition to establishing those sort of parameters of regulation for, you know, if you're driving a car, if you're watching kids, if you've got kids under your care, in addition to that, we've got to look at some of these substances like fentanyl and say, wait a minute, okay, there's something here that is more significant and that we do need to have government step in to an extent. And earlier this year, my news outlet published a pair of stories. The first story was related to a surge in fentanyl overdoses in South Carolina, data from the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control. And I quickly wanted to point to some of that. We're talking about a 59% increase in overdoses from fentanyl. And we're talking about a 105% increase statewide. 105%. Total overdoses in the Palmetto State in 2020. That's the latest year for which data is available. But we got 2021 data from the South Carolina State Law Enforcement Division, which was even more shocking. And again, this was all published this back in the spring. According to data from SLED, get this, a 2,593% spike of people. And that's the cases that were worked on by drug analysts at the South Carolina State Law Enforcement Division involving fentanyl. And as far as the items that were processed in their lab, drug items, get this, a 2,610% increase in fentanyl-related items that they tested. What does that tell you? That tells you fentanyl is the dominant drug. And here's the reason. It's cheap to make. It's cheap and it's powerful. And you start cutting it with stuff, all of a sudden you're spending less on your production. Your profit margins, if you're a drug dealer, go through the roof. I mean, imagine if this was happening when Pablo Escobar was rolling. I mean, scary stuff. But here's the problem is it is absolutely deadly. And Creighton Waters, I want to give Creighton Waters a little credit. We went to a press conference a few months ago. The Office of South Carolina Attorney General, and Creighton Waters, one of the deputy AGs, was there. And he made a point about the fentanyl epidemic and how if you get the wrong batch, all the Narcan in the world ain't going to save you. They're never going to be able to revive you. If you get just one hit of the wrong batch of this stuff, it's that powerful. It's that dangerous. And so today we're going to talk about what should be done, because I do think this is a situation where government has an obligation to establish some parameters for the people who are moving this stuff in and out of our communities. And that was something that was addressed by Mark Keel. He's the chief of the South Carolina State Law Enforcement Division. Now, Chief Keel and I have gone back and forth on drug issues. We are 100% at odds on, for example, the decriminalization of marijuana for recreational purposes and medical purposes. Chief Keel staunchly opposes both. I am 100% supportive of both. But Chief Keel and I are on the same page here, and I want to read what he said. He told me this week, fentanyl is a serious danger to all South Carolinians. The addition of a fentanyl trafficking statute, and that he's talking about a new state law, would hold those who are poisoning our communities accountable. Now, there have been efforts in the last two sessions of the General Assembly to pass this fentanyl trafficking statute, because currently, even if you've got 10,000 fentanyl pills, people, most you can get is possession with intent to distribute. There is no fentanyl trafficking statute on the books in South Carolina. There's trafficking for other drugs, put you in jail for a long time, not for fentanyl. Does that make sense? Does that make sense, particularly given this precipitous rise? And I'll hold this up. I talked about these numbers earlier. You can look at this. I'm not making this stuff up. Huge spikes. I'm probably blinding Dylan with this extra bright iPad. I was watching Jerry Maguire last night. I'm sorry, Dylan. I'm sorry, Brother Maguire. Anyway, huge spike. So given that spike, given the soaring overdose deaths tied to fentanyl, does it make sense to have a fentanyl trafficking statute? Again, I'm not a big supporter of new drug laws. I would argue yes. Now, of interest, there was apparently some horse trading in the legislature last session. There were some attempts to get a fentanyl trafficking statute passed as part of the decriminalization of marijuana, which I think would be a very smart idea. Take a drug that's not that dangerous, that a lot of people, frankly, should be allowed to use recreationally, free that up, but then tighten the penalties on fentanyl, which obviously much more dangerous. So again, that's something we ought to think about. Common sense. Everyone says, oh, drugs are bad, drugs are good. No, it's not that simple. Let's look at the actual substance. Let's look at the actual language of the laws. And let's do the common sense thing. Decriminalize pot and tighten the penalties for fentanyl. But anyway, this is a personal subject for me, again, as somebody who's a recovering addict. Somebody who hears stories every day about the damage done by this incredibly dangerous substance. But you better believe, as the next legislative session starts in January of 2023, this is going to be on the agenda, folks. And you can count on this news outlet to follow that and continue to push for common sense reform of South Carolina's drug statutes. All right, that's a wrap for this week's editions of The Week in Review. Before we go, one last reminder. If you haven't checked out Cheer Incorporated, go to Apple, go to Spotify, go to wherever you download podcasts. Listen to that first episode that was dropped this past week on Tuesday. Listen to that, because the second episode, folks, is going to be huge. That's dropping this coming Tuesday. Again, Cheer Incorporated on Apple, Spotify, wherever you download your podcast. And by the way, don't just listen to it, but share it. If you've got a friend with kids, families you know, because again, this is a case study on how we are treating future generations. Nothing is more important. So again, don't just listen, don't just download, but please share it with your friends, particularly if they've got children. And stay tuned for next week's editions of The Week in Review.